This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
So how are you feeling? No, I'm talking to you. Yeah, how are you feeling right now? How are you feeling physically? How are you feeling mentally, emotionally, spiritually? Okay, I tell you what. Why don't I just be fair and find out how you're feeling at the end of this hour, The God Show, having not been presented to you before, even though the guest has been presented to you before. Amy Julia Becker is our guest. And the last time, Amy, that you were on, we were talking about one of your books called White Picket Fences. And that has just a lovely kind of early American feel to it. What's that book about? Remind me.
Sure. White Picket Fences, and thank you for having me back.
Sure.
White Picket Fences is a memoir of really about my whole life, looking back on my childhood and adolescence and young adults and even into my, well, now I'm in my 40s, so all of those years through the lens of being a white woman in America with married parents and education and affluence, and asking, with all of these things that we've taken to calling privilege, how do I respond to the social divisions that are present in every aspect of American life? And how do I do that with hope and love and healing rather than shame or despair or indifference? So that's what White Picket Fences is.
And a little of that is also remembered in the new book, To Be Made Well, by Amy Julia Becker. So let me ask you, how's your back?
You know, my back is doing very well. Thank you for asking.
Well, it was a part of you being made well.
Yeah, absolutely. So about 10 years ago, my husband and I moved to Western Connecticut with three small children, and he was moving from a position as a teacher in a school to a head of a school. So it was a big move for him professionally, and then just literally a, you know, move from one town to another and all the things that means for a family, especially we had a six-year-old, four-year-old, and a one-year-old at the time. And so in the midst of those years of moving and settling in and early childhood for our kids, I really had what I can look back on and say was a bit of an identity crisis or a meltdown, or, you know, I don't know what you're going to call it. But over the course of those years, my lower back started to hurt. And I tried all sorts of things, whether that was, you know, doing stretches or getting a massage or trying yoga or doing core exercises. And eventually I was taking Advil every night in the middle of the night without fail. And I knew that there was something that just, I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. So I reached out to a friend who actually was a yoga teacher who helped people with kind of chronic pain issues. And I met with her, and the first thing she said when we were meeting together was, you know, typically when I hear people talk about having a problem with alignment, because that's what I said I thought I had a problem with, it means there's something that's not aligned in your life. It's not really about your body. And as soon as she said that, I just started talking about these years of feeling disrupted and feeling like I was not able to hold myself together and didn't know who to be as the wife of the head of school. And when I was only known as a mom and not as a person who had my own thoughts and my own contributions to the world. And over the course of that hour of sitting on this yoga mat and talking about the experiences of the previous few years, the pain in my back that had been present for, you know, persistently for months and off and on for years, dissipated. It just was like a valve was turned and it leaked out. And at the end of it, I said, I was like, I'm kind of embarrassed because, you know, here I am with a yoga teacher. We haven't moved. All I've done is talk. And I just suddenly feel better and feel like really better. Like I haven't felt this way in years. And she said to me, you know, the pain will probably try to come back. So we need to talk about what you do when it does. And I said, but I'm so confused because I have not fixed anything in my life. I've told you all the problems, but I haven't fixed anything. And she said, you know, healing doesn't need everything to be figured out in order to begin. It just needs you to acknowledge the source of the pain. Mm. And that was the beginning of a real journey for me, what it means to acknowledge the source of pain as the beginning of a healing path that, you know, as you know, because you've looked at the book, but took me down all sorts of different roads and asking all sorts of questions and really coming to, I think, a deeper understanding of what it means to be made well in a pretty comprehensive sense of that phrase.
You write extensively about yoga and Jesus. And I wonder, is there some link? I mean, I have never seen an artist's sketch of Jesus in the lotus position.
Mm-hmm.
Rarely do I ever hear them both in the same conversation, except in your book.
You know, it was a really fascinating thing for me to have this profound physical healing experience with a yoga teacher who is avowedly not a Christian. She's a spiritual person for sure and grew up in the Catholic Church, but would not call herself a Christian at this point. And I really had a lot of questions because I came to this as someone who reads the Bible and goes to church and prays and all of these things. And I was trying to reconcile the two. And yet what it really prompted me to do, that experience with Anne, was on the one hand, Anne, the yoga teacher, continued to meet with her over the years and just ask questions about healing from her perspective. Because I felt like what she was really able to offer me was a way to connect my body to my mind and my spirit. And I actually do think that like the Christian tradition has those tools, but not the tradition that I was raised in. I didn't really know. There was like this big disconnect between mind and body and spirit. But then I started looking again and again at the gospel stories of healing with Jesus. And I found that he also was connecting mind and body and spirit. So there wasn't as much of a disconnect, although, of course, there are things about, you know, a Buddhist and Hindu and Christian traditions that are different. And I don't mean to, like, blend them all together at all. But I did find that learning about healing, both through the gospel stories and also through a practice of yoga and these conversations with this woman, Anne, were incredibly helpful, all of a piece in terms of understanding healing in that mind, body, spirit, self, God, and community, you know, this bigger portrait of what healing is.
But wouldn't the blending of, if I may say something that would be not necessarily spiritual, but a blending of, let's say, the best of all of the world's faiths, it would seem to me that there would be some real advantage.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I certainly felt like for me, I was interpreting a lot of what I learned through Anne and occasionally through other yoga teachers or other practices. I was interpreting it through the lens of Christianity because that is the lens that I have. And there was real resonance where there was a sense of, you know, honestly, I would say the Spirit of God using those, not just the conversations, but like the literal embodied practices to teach me about myself and about what it meant to be someone who's been created in a body and with a body. And I don't know if that would be true for someone who came in with a different lens, if they could learn from Jesus and interpret that through a different lens. But I know for me, it was really helpful to have not just like abstract prayers that are in my head, but actual ways to bring prayer into my body, to bring parts of my body and my experience emotionally to God in prayer. It just all felt more connected.
Do you think that through whatever practice has been working for you, that you and others can heal diseases?
Yes and no. So I do think that there are, and I've done a lot of reading in these, it was actually probably 7 years ago that I first sat down on that yoga mat with Anne. So it's been a long time, even though the book, you know, has just come out, but, or is just about to come out. The what I've learned is that a lot of our diseases are stress related, and that's at this point, I think, considered scientific fact. It's not a, it's not something that's really contested. And so when we can identify whether it's environmental stress or emotional stress or physical stress in our lives and attend to it, that really can heal disease. At the same time, I think it can be too simplistic to say, like, we can get into a place of saying essentially it's your fault that you have a disease, and if you only thought about it better, then you would be well. And I think that is really dangerous and false territory. So I think we have to be really careful on both sides of that spectrum, in the sense that there's a real relationship between what we do, what we eat, what we believe about ourselves, what we believe about God, you know, and practices of healing and allowing and disease being healed and being changed and transformed. But then I also think that to then go from there to pointing a finger at people who are, you know, suffering from chronic pain or disease, or who have gotten a, you know, terminal cancer diagnosis, or who just like still limp because of a, you know, accident they had when they were a kid or something like that. Again, that's like a really oversimplified and hurtful way to think about healing. So
her name is Amy Julia Becker. She is the author of her latest book, To Be Made Well, which is subtitled An Invitation to Wholeness, Healing, and Hope. And you're someone who just sounds vivacious and enthusiastic and hopeful. Is that Amy Julia biographically from the time you were a child, or is that something that you've learned as you've continued this kind of self-study?
Ooh, that's such a great question. I think that I was vivacious and enthusiastic as a child, and then I think a lot of that got lost for, I don't know, my high school years at least. This is something else that I write about in the book, that when I was in high school, I both was under and put myself under so much pressure to perform and achieve that I literally, my stomach was literally paralyzed, and I was hospitalized for it. And I think there was just this, I had a year in college. I look back on it now, and all I wore was gray. I had like 17 gray sweaters.
Where did that come from, Amy? Excuse me for jumping in, but it sounds like another person that you're talking about.
I know. It is such a good question. And I think there was a combination of some, you know, family of origin dysfunction that I had not even seen, much less addressed. And so when you're in denial about pain, it can make that pain kind of go somewhere else. And I think in my case, and probably I was clinically depressed. I wasn't, you know, seeing a therapist or anything, so I don't know that. And I was never on any medication. But when I look back on it, I'm like, oh my gosh, like that girl was in trouble and was having such a hard time. But I also was just a really high achiever. So I was at Princeton University. This is my sophomore year in college. I was at Princeton University. I was getting straight A's. I was leading in various capacities and, you know, kind of doing everything right, you know, checking all those boxes. And yet internally, I was just having such a hard time. My stomach was still a mess. I was literally throwing up daily. It was very gross. And I was wearing gray all the time, and I was just so sad. So that is part of my healing journey, actually, is in beginning to connect mind, body, and spirit even back then, and then doing some of that work to go back and try to understand what it means to be a beloved human, not because of my performance and achievement, but simply because of being loved by God. Like, that's it. That's been a big part of the healing journey. So I think I've returned to some of that sense of like effervescence and enthusiasm that I do think I had as a child, but I did lose it for a while.
Throughout the book, To Be Made Well, I noticed there was a regular reflection on someone that you call the bleeding woman out of the Bible. Remind us who the bleeding woman was and why it had such an impact on you.
Yeah, so there's a story that comes up in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's gospel. In the book, I'm looking at Mark's version of it because it's the longest and probably the one that was first written down. And in it, there's a woman who we learn has been bleeding for 12 years. And she's sometimes referred to in churches as the woman with the issue of blood. So she's been bleeding for 12 years, and she comes up to Jesus in a crowd from behind and touches his, in our Bibles it says the hem of his garments. It's probably the tassels on his robe is actually what scholars think she touched.
Mm-hmm.
And she feels, it says that she feels immediately that her bleeding has ceased, and Jesus feels immediately that power has gone out from him. She then is ready to leave, like she's all done, but Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" and calls her essentially to come forward, which she, it says she does that trembling with fear. So she's worried that she's done something wrong in receiving this healing from Jesus. So she comes in front of him, and Mark tells us she told him the whole truth. And it's not totally clear what the whole truth is because we don't get her words. But earlier on, Mark has told us she's been bleeding for 12 years. She's spent all of her money. She's seen multiple doctors, and it's only gotten worse. So we get this picture of a woman who is destitute and in pain and outcast. And we know in Jewish culture, she would have been considered ceremonially unclean. And so she is, you know, just really on the outskirts of society. So she's telling Jesus the whole truth. We can imagine that all of that is included there. And then what he does is he says to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." So it's a really beautiful and tender scene and an encounter between Jesus and this woman that has just really taken my attention for many years. I mean, again, probably for that whole 7-year period as I've been thinking about healing. I've looked at a lot of the healing stories in the Bible and in the Gospels in depth, but that one captivated me because of the intimacy of that exchange and the different ways in which I see Jesus piecing her back together, right, in terms of her not just physically healing her, but restoring her by, in that word, daughter, like restoring her to God, restoring her to a sense of self and purpose, the affirmation that comes in saying your faith has healed you, and then sending her out into her community in peace. The fact that he does it publicly, because he's basically saying to everyone around her, she is back in your community. Make sure you receive her. She is no longer an outcast. So he's doing just this really big comprehensive work of healing that seems not just important to me, but also it just resonates with me in terms of what I long for and what I long for personally and for the people in my life.
Amy Julia, I don't have to tell you that right now in this international broadcast, The God Show, there are countless people who are bleeding, either literally, as in Ukraine, or figuratively, everywhere in the world there is pain. So would you mind, please, if I really challenge you to tell all of us and them how we can touch the garment of Jesus?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there, I have two answers. The second one is the, like, here are the step-by-step, you know, here's what you can do. Like, here's the pattern that we see in the Gospels. And I do think that's a helpful pattern, or I wouldn't have studied it and I wouldn't be sharing it. But before I say that, I want to give the second answer, which is that some pain remains. And again, that is not the fault of the sufferer. And I just think it's so important to underscore that. Even in this case of this woman, she had been in pain and suffering for 12 years, which is to say it was a long time. And there's no sense that she had done something wrong by seeking out help from doctors or by spending her money or by looking for it. And for whatever reason, Jesus didn't come along until that day. So we have examples in scripture, you know, the Apostle Paul, who has a thorn in his side that God says, "I'm not going to take away." And there's a lot of reason to believe that involved whatever that thorn in the side was, involves physical pain. So I just want to I don't know, claim or name that we do often bear witness to the brokenness of our world in our bodies. And I think, I mean, the situation in Ukraine is a perfect example of that, that we all would say this is evidence of like sin and brokenness and things that are not right in the world. And there are people who bear the marks of that in their very bodies. So with that said, I also think we see a pattern in scripture that the first thing we need to do if we want healing is acknowledge the pain. And so that sense of not denying or ignoring or avoiding pain, but actually facing it. And that might be true, again, on a physical level, so that instead of taking the Advil, which I'm not in any way opposed to taking Advil, but instead of taking the Advil saying, okay, wait, what is this pain that I'm having every single day? What am I going to do about it, right? So there's an acknowledgement of pain, whether that's physical, emotional, or the pain that I think exists in like our history, in our relationships with one another, things like that. The second thing is to ask for help, and that's where we see her reaching out her hand, right, is that asking for help. And asking for help, I think, can happen on a spiritual level through prayer, and it also can happen on a physical level, on a relational level, on a literally going to other people and saying, I'm at the end of my rope and I need help and I don't know what to do. But asking for help is also, I mean, it can be hard. We can, you know, call the doctor and the doctor doesn't have an appointment for 3 months, or we can call a friend and they don't have time to talk to us, or we can get in line for a therapist and they've got a wait list, you know. So I don't mean to say that asking for help is easy. And yet, even once we've acknowledged pain, that is, I think, the next step is to ask for help. And then I think there's a sense of believing. Well, there's a guy named Greg Boyle who has written a couple of books. And in one of them, he talks about surrendering to healing. There is a sense of just believing that God actually does heal and wants to heal us because of our belovedness, like that we are a beloved child of God. That's where that word daughter in that story it means so much. And I think for us to actually understand ourselves as children of God who are beloved by God is an aspect of our healing, and something we need in order to really receive healing. And then the final thing I'll say is that there is an element of bringing all of ourselves to God for healing, not just the shiny parts. Henry Nouwen, who's a spiritual writer, I'm sure you're familiar with, Henry Nouwen writes about bringing our brokenness under the blessing of God. And so not shying away from the wounded parts, but bringing them to God, believing Jesus when he says, blessed are those who mourn, blessed are those who are poor in spirit. And so like receiving a blessing in that place of brokenness seems to me to also be a part of our healing. None of those are super practical answers. And so I will say one more thing, which is I have found that like actually praying where I'm paying attention to pain or tension in my body can be a helpful way of beginning that process of looking kind of where's the pain and how can I bring it to God and receive healing in that place. And also praying in a way that actually brings the love of God into my sense of self. That's another way that I have been helped in this process of learning how to heal.
You've learned a great deal from so many others, and you give them credit. Clergy, you've learned from your yoga teacher. I wonder, particularly because of the other book in your life that I so admire because of the direction that it takes and also the title, Small Talk. And Small Talk, subtitled, Learning from My Children About What Matters Most. What have you learned from those kids that you called Penny and William and Merrily?
Well, I've learned a lot. And let's see, Small Talk came out in 2014, so I've learned a lot even since that book was written 8 years ago. Our oldest daughter, Penny, has Down syndrome, and she's now 16. So I've had a lot of time to learn from her. And this is true of all of our kids, but perhaps particularly from Penny. I have learned a lot about belovedness. Any infant, you know, is really generally beloved by their parents, and all they are is needy. You know, they're not doing anything to quote unquote deserve the love or earn the love or perform for the love, right? And if anything, they're like, you know, causing sleeplessness and hardship relatively. And yet there is a sense of belovedness. But I've also, I think, learned from Penny what it means to be a vulnerable human. That has certainly always been true of me, but I think I learned to protect and hide that vulnerability in a way that has been much harder for her because of living with disability. And instead of seeing vulnerability as something that needs to be hidden and that is something to be ashamed of, I think she's helped me to understand that vulnerability is actually what allows us to open ourselves up to love and to giving and receiving from one another, to being in positions not just of having a way to bring blessing and goodness into the world, but also needing other people to do that for me. So there's, I guess, a sense of reciprocity that I've learned from having all of our kids, but especially having Penny in my life. I mean, I've learned so many things, but those are the ones that come to the top of the list, that sense of belovedness, vulnerability, and mutuality, like giving and receiving. And I guess within all of that, what does it mean to be a child of God and to be able to really live out of a place of dependence, trust, and doing all of that while getting things wrong, you know, because kids do that all the time. they interact with their parents and they're clear that they haven't gotten it all right. And that doesn't change the fact that they're going to ask their parents, you know, for the raspberry shake at the, you know, drugstore or whatever. They're going to ask for what they need and they're going to ask for what they want and they're not going to apologize for it a lot of the time.
I'm laughing as a parent, thinking back on the communication skills of children. Small talk is what Amy Julia Becker calls it in a book that I'm assuming is still available.
That is true. Yes, it is.
Because your publisher would certainly see it no other way. It's also, I think, very good for an awful lot of parents around the world to hear how much you can learn from Penny, your Down syndrome child.
Hmm.
I think sometimes people tend to make generalities. I don't have to tell you, as the parent of a Down syndrome child, where generalities are so often made and so often totally fallacious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we have a lot of assumptions about what it means to be a person with a disability and with an intellectual disability in general. And I carried, you know, all of those assumptions in my own heart and mind when Penny was born. And I didn't even know that until she was born. And I had to confront the expectations I had about who she was and what our family would be. And then essentially the prejudices I had to thinking that there were, you know, certain things that made a human valuable. And thankfully, over time, I have not only gotten to know Penny, but actually gotten to know many people who live with disabilities, whether that's Down syndrome or other intellectual or physical disabilities. And I've started to recognize our common humanity and the ways in which really different bodies and minds are important, valuable, necessary to all of us. And so the fact that I have a certain intellect that I can bring into the world, that's great. And the fact that other people have really different gifts is equally crucial. And we really need each other. But it did take me having a pretty profound encounter with my own child and my own set of expectations and assumptions to recognize that I had easily dismissed lots and lots of people because they weren't like me for a lot of my life. And so I had a lot of relearning to do.
If you have such strong beliefs in our abilities, all of us, our abilities to do personal healing through spirituality and self-awareness and the variety of things that you have in the book. Does that make Amy Julia Becker anti-medicine?
No, it does not. I think medication is one aspect of healing. What I think, though, is that we have put all of our faith, essentially, in medication. And I think that's where we've gone wrong. So we see a tremendous amount of chronic pain and chronic disease and depression, also kind of mental illness and emotional illness in our society, because I think the role of medication is often to stop the pain or to pause the pain enough so that we can do some of that deeper work. And that, you know, people who have had, I don't know, torn their ACL or something, some part of the knee, you know that like the surgery might be necessary, but you're not going to really heal unless you also do the physical therapy. And if you're not mindful of, well, what got me here in the first place, whether that was, you know, I kind of impulsively ran after a soccer ball, having not done that in, you know, 20 years, or whether, and sometimes, of course, these injuries just happen and it's not like we've done something wrong, but bringing some mindfulness around the pain that we have in our bodies and spirits does not mean that we don't need medication, whether that is, you know, like an Advil or an antibiotic or something like an antidepressant. But I do think there's almost always a deeper level of healing that is not going to come through medication.
I'm thinking that as I've read the book and your background, theologically, spiritually, socially, that so much of your faith is based on your strong belief in the lessons learned in the Bible. And the healing that goes with that. What about the listener right now who is a Jew in pain?
Well, I think if you are a Jew in pain, then there's, again, there is a, you know, obviously a biblical tradition that involves healing and that involves really, I think, the truths about who we are as humans that Jesus is referring to. So there is a, if you are a Jewish person who is a believer in the Bible, the Jewish scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, then I think you can go back to the book of Genesis and see that there is a sense of being, again, being made well by God, having a God who is a creator. And that shows up again in like Psalm 139, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And so that sense of being restored to our mind, body, and spirit, and to God, there's also a Jewish concept of shalom, which I believe Jesus is referring to when he sends, for example, this woman back out into the world in peace. It's like, bring the healing that you have received out into the world with you. That's a very Jewish concept. But I also think that you know, healing is possible for all of us. I think it's possible for people who do not believe in God. I think it's possible for people who have a sense of God as a more, you know, mystical, spiritual being and not a personal savior in the form of Jesus, which is what I believe. And I still think that the ways in which we can look to connect mind, body, spirit, and community will bring healing. And that's true. I think it's all the more true when God is involved and acknowledged, but I don't think that it makes it impossible or irrelevant for people who are not in that place of you know, having the same belief as I do.
That's a good response. And I say that, I say that hoping that it doesn't sound pompous of me making judgments about what you believe and what they believe. But I never want people to feel as if they're left out because somebody is talking about Krishna, or they're talking about Jesus,
right,
or they're talking about Muhammad. I want everybody to listen to the God Show and find out what it is they can use. And in this particular case, when we're talking about to be made well, boy, that's about as important a subject as you can find. And you talk about the ways to find those healing practices and the approach to healing that we have access to, not just in the book by Amy Julia Becker, but we have access to by our own nature. But what are the barriers to healing?
Yeah, so the middle section of the book is about the barriers to healing. And I write about four barriers: distraction, shame, anxiety, and status, like our social status in the world. I think all of those show up in that story of the bleeding woman and then Jairus, who is a synagogue ruler, who's also coming to Jesus and asking for healing. But I think all of those things also show up in my own life, where I am distracted or numbing myself through, you know, entertainment and productivity, honestly. That's one way to get away from even acknowledging that I need healing. Then if I cut through that layer of distraction, what I often encounter is a sense of shame. But that shame also keeps me, I want to hide when I experience that shame, rather than believe my belovedness, right, and receive healing in that place. Anxiety or fear can also just be a barrier to healing because of the energy to try to control my life instead of to trust in God's provision and to really relinquish my sense of I need to do this all for myself. And then I think social status can be a barrier to healing because it divides us from one another. It cuts us off from community. It cuts us off from a sense of common humanity. And all of those things are really necessary for healing. That said, what I love about the stories in the gospel and what I think is true about God's healing work is that the barriers to healing do not keep God from being a God of healing. They're not like impenetrable barriers. It's not like, oh, well, you've got to go figure out all of your problems with distraction, get rid of your shame, overcome your anxiety, and overcome your, you know, problems with social status, and then you can get healed. I mean, that's just not the case at all. At the same time, noticing what is keeping me from healing, I think, can be really helpful, was certainly really helpful for me, and is something that can help all of us to actually come to a place of recognizing our need and bringing it before God for help and for, again, that sense of being welcomed and loved, and then being sent out to create spaces of welcome, of love, of belonging, and of community and healing for one another.
In your segment in the book that highlights and focuses on barriers to healing, the word that you just used jumped out. And let's concentrate on that for a couple of minutes, okay? That is the barrier of shame. Tell me about that.
You know, for a long time, I thought that I was someone who did not struggle with shame. It was something I heard a lot about, and I was like, well, I feel guilty sometimes, but I don't feel shame. Like, I'm pretty, you know, confident in myself and my abilities and blah, blah, blah. And then I read a book by Kurt Thompson, who is, let's see, what's the name of his book is The Soul of Shame. I read that book. And I was just kind of interested in it. And then one of the things he said is that one of the refrains that people who are struggling with shame often have is the refrain of not being enough. And when I read that, I was like, oh, no, that is me all the time. I'm always feeling like, and even saying the words, that I'm not good enough. I'm not a good enough mom. I'm not a good enough wife. I'm not a good enough writer. I'm not a good enough whatever it is. And so when I read that book, I was just really aware that I actually did have serious issues with shame. Brené Brown is another famous, you know, contemporary writer who's written a lot about shame. And I've really appreciated her work as well. And again, been like, oh, yes, ding, 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 that would be me. So once I recognized that I really do struggle with shame, then there's the question of, well, what do you do with it? And I think there are lots of ways that we can address shame. And again, seeing it being the first thing that we need. But for me, I did have an experience in prayer that was really powerful when I was just learning how to contemplate the love of God And I had this experience where I essentially saw myself bringing all of my achievements to God. And again, I mentioned earlier that that's kind of a chronic source of stress for me, is like needing to perform and achieve. So I was bringing all my achievements to God and placing them in God's lap. And so it was like, here are the books I've written and the awards I've won and the degrees I've received and the children I've had and all of this. And I brought it all to God and heard God say, but there's no room for you. You're going to need to take this all away. Mm. And so one by one, I had to remove all of the awards and achievements and books and children and so forth in order to go and be present. And there was this sense in that experience that I had of God saying, you are enough. I don't need all of these other trappings from your life in order to receive you, to welcome you, to love you. And not to say I don't struggle with shame anymore, like, oh, poof, it was all gone. But that was a really profound experience for me of healing, and of recognizing some of the lies that I have allowed myself to believe about myself that have kept me in a place of shame rather than in a place of, I guess, like humble confidence in my belovedness.
But what if it's not you telling yourself, no, you have to continue to strive to be better, that you've fallen short? What if it's somebody else in your life? What if it's a parent as a child is growing up into adulthood, and that's what they remember? You fall short. It wasn't good enough. You got a B plus instead of an A minus. You know, yeah, you got down to the 5-yard line, but you didn't score the touchdown. What if it's a parent, or what if it's a spouse saying regularly, you're not good enough? How do you manage a healing attitude about yourself in that environment?
Yeah, what a great question. I think in those situations, there is a sense of learning to recognize the lies that we have been told. And going back, when we're talking about, you know, as an adult, looking back on childhood and recognizing some childhood wounds, and again, the lies that, you know, sometimes I'm sure some of us had, you know, really abusive parents and it was just a bad situation. Others of us had parents who were doing the best they could and it still ended up harming us, which is what I'm, you know, sure I'm doing with my children like daily. So that sense of even the best meaning of parents can do, say things and do things that we interpret in ways that are really harmful and are not true. So I do think trying to do some work to go back and say, oh my gosh, this is what I used to believe about myself. How can I notice when that is happening and bring it into the light and replace it with something that is true? So instead of I'm not enough, to say, this is good enough. This is good enough. Or God is enough. God's love is enough, right? You know, I was actually, oh my gosh, I was trying to do some videos today that go along with this book release. The words are my like forte, images, not so much. I mean, I was so terrible. And I finally said, I was like, you know what? It just has to be good enough. Instead of me trying to be a perfectionist about this, it has to be good enough. And some of that for me has come from looking back on my childhood and trying to go back there and say to that little girl, you know, you are good. You are good enough. And again, God's love is enough for you. So I think that's part of it. I think if for any of us who are in like toxic relationships or abusive relationships right now, there may need to be an actual break in that relationship in order for healing to happen. Because certainly, you know, healing can't happen when you continue to be wounded over and over and over again. So again, I don't mean to say this is just an easy matter of like think positive thoughts. And it's going to be different, of course, from situation to situation. And yet understanding where the lies are and learning how to believe that belovedness is crucial. And that's true now, but it's also true in terms of going back into our past and being healed from some of those old wounds, is bringing that belovedness into those places. And helping our essentially like child self believe that God is present with us, was present in those moments, and that the truth about who we are is actually stronger and deeper than the lies that we might have heard as we were growing up.
Amy Julia Becker is talking about how it is that we can all be made well, primarily by doing it ourselves, so many different directions. And, you know, as we've been talking on The God Show, it did occur to me, Amy Julia, that it's not beyond belief on this program that is heard on so many different platforms in so many different areas of the world. It's not difficult for me to believe that somebody is listening in Poland right now, an immigrant who escaped Ukraine. And and here we are, we're talking about healing ourselves from the hurts and the stumbles in our business lives and our romantic lives, and all of those things. Is it even possible for a human being to heal oneself from the catastrophe of war?
Well, that's where I think there are. So we do have kind of power within ourselves, for sure. And yet we are really connected to one another. And one of the traumas of war is the way in which our the way we're meant to be knit together as a human family is torn apart, right? And so there is a sense of, yes, we have ways to make ourselves well personally. Yes, we can have a personal relationship with God in which healing is experienced. And yet there is a dependence upon one another, that healing depends upon one another also. And I think one of the traumas of a time like this is the breakdown of those possibilities and of the trust between humans. So yes, I do believe healing is possible, but I also think that it's, and you're certainly not minimizing any of that reality, as you say, like the trauma of war is very different than the trauma of having, you know, believed some lies about myself when I was a kid, right? And so, and yet, there is still, and we have survivors of all sorts of traumatic situations who can attest to the healing they've received when they are in a safe and loving community. And that's where the communal and social aspect of healing, I think, is really important. I believe that God works through people. I mean, and again, from a Christian perspective, this is the idea of like the body of Christ is the people who are doing the work of Jesus and including the work of healing, which sometimes takes the form, I've heard of miracles, but often takes the form of holding hands and bringing a meal and providing shelter and listening to one another and giving money and offering compassion. So I do think that we, the world, are a part of, if there is to be any healing when these traumatic events happen and unfold and, you know, are ongoing, we are called to be a part of that healing as a global community. And I don't know, you know, right now what that feels like for me is that I can pray for the people I know by name and for those more generally who are in Ukraine. There may be more that becomes obvious as time goes on. But I do believe that as we love and as we give of ourselves in healing ways, that is participating in a wider work of bringing healing and bringing shalom into the world.
Amy Julia, in all of your books, you don't seem to balk at offering readers your own deep personal experiences in healing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to give you another opportunity.
Okay.
What ill of any kind did you have the most difficult time healing in your own life?
The most difficult time. Well, I mean, honestly, this was my stomach situation. When I was, I think I was 15 years old when my stomach was first paralyzed, and I think I was 21 when I would say I was like fully healed from that. It was a really long time. And part of that was just because of the amount of denial I was in and just not really understanding how to heal.
And what do medical people say about that? I want to jump in to ask you so that we can define what we're talking about regarding stomach paralysis. What do they call it?
So they call it gastroparesis. Mm-hmm. And my stomach had, if your stomach moves, like, you know, has just what's called motility. And typically there's blood in your stomach walls that's like digesting and processing food. And my stomach had like 10% of a typical stomach's motility. So it was essentially not processing food. And it's a very rare situation. Not like no one else has it. And there are motility medications. But those did not seem to be helpful to me. And then what happened was because no food was moving through my system, I then began to regurgitate my food. And so a whole host of other gastrointestinal problems started and continued. But what was also going on was that I was kind of okay with all of this because it meant that I would not gain any weight and could eat whatever I wanted. So I had a really psychological illness as well as this physical one. And I was not willing to integrate those and say there are multiple problems and we need help in all of these areas. And so it was that lack of connection, not to say I couldn't have been harmed, you know, I don't know whether I would have had the paralyzed stomach in the first place without the thoughts that were very happy to have the paralyzed stomach. And yet they reinforced one another in a way that meant healing was a long way off.
In a way, you were another bleeding woman.
I think that's part of that sense of resonance for me with that story is just that I was really looking. I mean, I did. I went to people and had them pray for me, and I went to doctor after doctor after doctor, and, you know, I tried all sorts of things, and it was really hard and really alienating. And yet it also took a long time before healing could happen.
But what finally worked, Amy Julia?
For me, there were some stages along the way. But what finally worked was a sense of integration where I was getting physical therapy on my stomach. And so I would go to a woman who was essentially massaging my stomach with her hands. And while she was doing that, she would ask me questions. And that might be a question about, you know, food that I like to eat or about my boyfriend or about my schoolwork. Excuse me. But I would just talk. And I think, again, it was nothing deep or spiritual, but talking and having someone working on my body. And I think there was at that point a desire to be made well. Honestly, all of that together really contributed in such a way that it wasn't instantaneous, but there was like a steady progression towards healing throughout that year, which I think was my junior year in college.
I'm glad you told us that story, though, because that relates to so many people with so many organic and gastric problems saying, well, hey, you know what? Nothing is going to work except continuing this medication over and over and over again. By the way, here's a real challenge. You have less than 2 minutes to tell everybody in our audience, everyone, I'm talking about every individual out there, no matter where they live or what language they speak, how to begin healing themselves.
I think to begin, it begins with believing that you are worth healing. So beginning with belovedness, and yet also knowing that healing is not an achievement, it's a gift. So putting yourself in a place of receptivity to acknowledge pain, to ask for help, and then to receive the healing that is yours to have, the healing of mind, of body, of spirit, and of the community, of the relationships around you, whether that is with God or with other people, and also, of course, within yourself.
Can it work for everyone?
I believe that healing is for each of us, and it is for all of us. I don't believe it always looks the way we expect it to.
With that thought, I'm going to remind you that we've just spent some time with Amy Julia Becker. The name of the book, so that you can spend some time with her, is To Be Made Well. And I tell you what, for all of you, Amy and I have something in common. We both wish you health. This is Pat McMahon on The God Show.